which makes you effectively the Chancellor of the Exchequer. Must be a lot of pressure for you, knowing that so many people are sort of relying on money from decisions you make. Is it a lot of pressure? How do you cope with it?
I know it sounds a cliche, but we do have a very good team of people here. They are very committed. They've stuck with the organisation through our difficult time of planned closure, collecting and distributing the money that we were entitled to and to spend really well. That makes my job a lot easier. I think it helps that we are committed to being transparent in the way we go about collecting and the way we spend. I think that helps because it means that we're able to explain to people how decisions have been made or why we've taken one route rather than another. I'm sure every job's got its pressures. I don't think this one is any worse than any others, and I do get to go racing, which is not bad.
Now, have you always been a racing fan?
Yeah, it's been something I've been really into since I was a kid, for whatever reason. You get into things when you're really young. Racing really bit me as a kid. I suppose football and racing were my two childhood obsessions. But racing really more than any other, for reasons that I can't immediately or never really looked into to work it out. I don't come from a racing background, but I suppose my family would be what you'd call Saturday punters, or were. So racing would always have been on a Saturday afternoon on TV. And I just really got into it from a young age. I think probably everyone starts with a Grand National bet. I think mine was on Spartan Missile in the 81 National, I think it was. So when I was eight, and things have just gone on from there, and just always had a plan to work in racing somehow, never quite knowing how to do it. And I think it's really, probably like a lot of things, it's quite difficult when you're completely out of it to find a way in. But I think I did all the usual things of writing to lots of people for work experience, and got a couple of breaks along the way, and then things have gone on from there. Yeah.
Now, I think to reach the top of your sphere of racing, as you have, I understand you went to school in Stoke Newington, which is not your normal hotbed of racing high flyers. I mean, how did you know? You must have really been driven in your education to start a comprehensive to make your way to where you are now.
Yeah, I suppose so. I do recall, and I think about this, that I think I went through my entire school career without anyone being interested in racing, maybe betting a bit more, but no one interested in racing. And I do find it quite amusing that I have some envy when I hear, I've seen your other interviews where people have said that they had a racing club and everything else at school, and you think, wow, you know, that must have been incredible. So no, I think it was a real solitary activity, you know, flicking through the Weekender and Race Form Update, if that's what they were called then in the 80s, and buying those every week, and purely for my own entertainment. But I didn't really expect to get a career in racing. I'm not sure that you do when you're coming from anything outside an industry. But I just had a few lucky breaks along the way where I got on the BHB, as it was then, graduate programme, and just had a lot of good fortune along the way to get the right breaks.
Now, you said that not many people are interested in racing, but, you know, more interested in betting. And it seems that, I've asked other people this, but in recent years, seems to be a body of people trying to attach a sort of stigma to betting, where it's always been an accepted part of the UK sort of fabric. Do you feel that there is a concerted effort to try and demean the betting industry from certain parties?
Well, I think there's plenty of books and articles about this, the new Puritanism, as it's been described in some places. It's quite interesting that you have the view of betting in different parts of the world at different parts of that cycle. You've got some parts of the world where betting hasn't been mainstream, that's becoming mainstream, where, and opportunities are opening up all over the world for betting operators. And you've got Britain, which has really gone through that period of it being something that wasn't encouraged at all, then betting shops coming in, then it becoming a very mainstream leisure area, the lottery being introduced and a whole expansion of betting, and now thinking through, as you see everywhere, questions about the scale of betting's promotion and an increased focus on the vulnerable. So all of that, I think, is almost a natural cycle. I don't think it's something to be afraid of. I think it's something that that racing and betting have got to work through together, because intrinsically, racing is an amazing, fantastic sport to be part of, and betting is one of the great liberating social activities that people do in this country, and it provides an enormous amount of enjoyment to the overwhelming majority. But there has to be, and should be, in the same way as racing will have to have an absolute increased focus on equine welfare and equine matters, no doubt the betting industry will do exactly the same when it comes to player protection, promotion, children's access to betting, and so on. But these are all things that I absolutely believe that the industries are capable of doing, because they are full of people who want the best for their industries, and they are things that provide a great upsides, and it's understandable and nothing to be sneered at that good people express concerns about things that maybe they weren't expressed 20 years ago. That's absolutely fine. People should have those concerns expressed, as long as the industries can deal with them, which they can.
Now, anyone that's got a online betting account will know that you quite often get offers come through, bet £5, free spins on the casino, that sort of thing. Do you feel that some online bookmakers effectively use the sport to draw people in, and then to try and distract their money to easier sort of ways of relieving them of it? Do you think sort of racing's been made a fool of in that respect?
Well, I hear that, and I think if you look at there must be something in it to some extent, that if you can use something else to get people in and then get them to play something else while they're there, that probably happens. I'm sure it does happen. But I think what matters to racing and to betting on sport generally is, are you getting people in at all? And then are they then motivated to continue to have an interest in the sport on an ongoing basis? I think if you look at the work that's been done on customer segmentation, that there's quite a bit that suggests that people aren't attracted particularly to switching over on a sustained basis. What they're interested in is what they're interested in. Yes, you can at the margins try to get people to convert over, but there isn't a whole scale transferring of interest over. I think for betting on racing, I completely understand why some elements of racing say that basing the entire levy on gross profit has its risks, because racing isn't getting a clip of every bet on racing. I think these are all arguments to be run for the future. We've been around the houses on them ourselves here, looking at turnover, gross profit, per play charges or fixed amounts per operator. These are all things that are looked at from time to time. But really the issue for racing on an ongoing basis is, are you providing something that is sufficiently attractive for people coming in to the sport? And I think if you look at the international numbers for betting on racing, British racing is still right up there as one of the top two or three grossing countries in the world. I think you've got Hong Kong, and you've got America and Japan and the UK. Betting on racing is still incredibly popular here. So yeah, I do see, of course, the point that people are cross-marketed other products when they come in. But do I think that that's necessarily costing racing a lot of money? I'm sure the bookmakers would say actually what they're doing is providing a range of betting opportunities or gambling opportunities for punters, and they'll spread their money on everything because they're more interested. So I suspect there's more to it than just the sheer there's an offer, it must be taking money away. I suspect it's quite a detailed piece of work needed to understand the true impact.
Well, there's obviously people all aware about the Fogarty campaign, which ended up, you know, resulted in the stakes being lowered. Now, criticism now is that you can just go online on your phone, bet with UK bookmakers to any sort of amount you want. You think if the government turned their attention now to the online casino aspect of bookmakers and regulated that the same as they have the FOBTs, that they would be, the bookmakers would be forced to start promoting racing more again and trying to give the punters more to bet on revolving around racing? That would be good for the sport as a whole?
Well, I think you're right that the government have said that looking at the regulation of online gambling will follow. Some of the high profile campaigners against fixed odds betting terminals have said that now that has been dealt with in the shops, it's right then to look online. So I'm sure that the online market will be looked at as well. And yes, that there must be an opportunity for racing in there to get some more market share if it ends up that there's a reduction in activity away from existing products. But I think we'll be able to tell a bit about that in the next couple of years with FOBTs, because clearly the argument has been run by racing perfectly logically that if there are fewer opportunities to bet on machines in shops, the punter will bet more on racing while they're there. I think the answer to that question turns on what I said earlier, which is to what extent are they completely separate markets? If somebody is interested in betting on machines, there's something about what's there on a casino type game or a game on a screen that isn't the same as betting on sport. Maybe there'll be very little crossover, but I don't think that, I think unless you work for a bookmaker, I think it's really difficult to get a really accurate answer to that question of what is likely to happen if you change the offering in one area. But in theory, yes, if there were fewer opportunities available, but the same people wanted to bet the same amount of money, would that money be spread on existing products? Yeah, it should have some impact. But I don't think even the most optimistic person in racing would say if there are shop closures due to FOBT reductions coming in, all of that money will find its way back into racing in some way. There's going to be some dislocation, and the question is, how much of it can you avoid?
Okay, today I'm in London at the Levy Board HQ with Alan Del Monte. Thank you very much for agreeing to talk to us today, Alan. So, 1st of April, it all changed for you guys, didn't it?
Well, it didn't. That's the first surprise. We'd been expecting to be abolished in April this year, and that's been something that's been on the cards for a few years. And quite a lot of the work we've been doing over the last couple of years was getting ready for not being here. But that's all changed now. The plan to abolish the levy board was shelved in the early part of this year. The government's plan, or the way the government planned to do it, didn't work. So it's back to the drawing board. And now it's an interesting, exciting time for us because we're starting to come out of the cave, blinking into the light, and thinking about our future and getting ourselves ready for the next chapter.
Okay, so why did the government want to change things after 50 odd years of?
Well, I think the levy board's history has been one that's been punctuated by attempts to get rid of it on and off. Racing has had an understandable, long-held ambition to get hold of the levy money. And different attempts have been made to try and do that. All of them haven't worked for one reason or another. The latest one came about for a number of reasons, but as part of government's desire to streamline in the public sector, after a long consultation process, it came to a view that the levy board's functions could be transferred out to an existing body on the collection side, to the Gambling Commission, and the distribution of the money would go directly to racing. In the end, the savings that was likely to make actually weren't going to be that great. Getting rid of one body and creating two is always going to lead to some reduction in your cost saving. But as much as anything, it was about trying to give racing direct control of the expenditure. And where it went wrong is the parliamentary committees that looked at the options or the proposed way of doing it came to a view that it was better to leave a public body in place doing the job of looking after what are public funds. And that's something that we have always taken very seriously. They didn't stop being publicly raised monies just because you were giving the money over to racing. So the option of having another go and getting rid of the levy board is still there for the government, and those arguments can all be run in the future. But for now, we're focusing on doing our job of collecting, distributing the levy, making sure that what we do is transparent and open, cost effective, and trying to give confidence to the betting industry, to racing, and to the government that we're managing those funds properly.
Okay, now I understand that you're actually formed when betting shops became legal to compensate for the expected downturn in attendances on race courses. Can you just explain what in 2000, now you do? What is the general business day for, the levy board?
Well, at its simplest, and don't tell anyone it's this easy, but we collect money from bookmakers and spend it on racing, and that's the job. More technically, we collect 10% of the gross profit of bookmakers who have taken bets on British racing from British-based punters. And at the end of the year, that money is collected around this time of year, April time, from bookmakers, or the final amount is collected this year. And then we spend that money on racing on a whole range of things through the year. So last year, we raised about 95 million. That's a big increase on what it was in the years before 2017. We've just extended the levy to bookmakers outside Britain, which was a change that took a long time coming, but has now put the finance of the levy board on a much better footing. And we provide a substantial sum towards the prize money for every race course. We provide about 2/3 of the regulation cost, several million in equine welfare and veterinary research, several million for racing industry staff training, and so on. So what we do is try to support what racing is doing in a number of its key areas and apply that money in a sensible, where we can, measurable, cost-effective way.
Okay, you mentioned the extra money now from 2016-17. When you, after that, you started to be able to get money from the offshore bookmakers. That's like nearly 50 million, well, 45 million pounds extra. So all those years previously that you couldn't collect it, that's an awful lot of money that racing lost. What is there any reason why?
Yeah, for a very long time, let's go back right to the 1960s. The legislation that governs the levy board has been around since the 60s and was pretty much unchanged since it began. And when the levy was formed, as you say, as a compensation for racing, almost all betting was done in Britain with bookmakers based in Britain. So the question of trying to capture money from outside Britain was a non-issue. And it became an issue, a growing issue, with, first of all, some telephone operators moving outside of Britain, but then particularly from the early to mid-2000s, as bookmakers move their online businesses out of Britain. The levy legislation just couldn't cope with it. And one of the problems that we had was that we couldn't unilaterally change the legislation. It's Parliament that changes legislation. And because the levy was such an old piece of legislation, the advice that government had always had was that you couldn't easily change the legislation without creating a what is known as a state aid in European law. So we wrote to the government in 2010 to say, unless something happened to change the legislation, the levy yield would continue to go down. And it was difficult for government to act. But what changed was there was a 2013 decision in Europe that seemed to open the way for the changes to be made to the levy legislation. That, combined with a number of politicians who were very keen to help modernise the levy structure, plus some work by Racing in pressing home that advantage, led to a real momentum behind the change happening. So really from about 2015, we knew that unless it fell over a legal hurdle, the levy would get extended, and it came in April 17. So we're now getting a lot of extra money in, as you say, 40 million plus from bookmakers outside Britain. We did have a number of voluntary deals in place through the early to mid 2010s that mitigated some of that lost revenue. But really, I think as everybody could recognise, it was only by actually changing the law to extend the levy completely that you can really get the full amount of the money in.
Yeah, so a lot of bookmakers got away with a lot of money for a long time. So does it fall a little bit on deaf ears when they're screaming now that they're going to lose lots of revenue, you know, because of the FOBTs, and they're going to get closed betting shops and all the rest of it? I mean, should have plenty in reserve, shouldn't they?
Not really, because number one, the bookmakers were doing what the law said, and the law was that if you weren't in Britain, you didn't pay. Number two, not all of the bookmakers that were not paying are the same bookmakers that have retail estates. So I don't think anybody's really looking back at what happened. I think there is a real obvious issue coming up for the betting industry, the retail betting industry, and for racing with the FOBT changes that have come in April. We know that there is going to be a significant effect on revenues to racing from media rights, and obviously revenues to bookmakers first of all, and then that's a knock-on effect onto racing. To what extent the levy is affected is more difficult to predict, even if you knew that X number of shops were going to close, because you don't know exactly which shops will close. The media rights contracts, although we don't know the exact detail of every contract, pretty much every shop that closes will lead to a reduction in income. Whereas in a levy environment, because it's based on gross profit, if some of the business from a shop moves to another shop or moves online, then the damage to the levy will be more limited. But at the moment, we're finding it quite difficult to be very precise in our forecasts. All that we've said to our board is that we know that there will be an impact. It won't be as severe as the impact more generally, so we should be cautious about what we commit to spend. But beyond that, we haven't said that it's something that needs, for the levy board at the moment, a massive rethinking of expenditure. It's more a case of being very alert and alive to what's happening, monitoring shop closures as they happen.
Okay, now when that massive windfall, well, not windfall, extra revenue started to come in, where did you prioritise that money?
The number one priority was not to spend all of it, because the levy board had drawn on its reserves for a number of years. At one point, I think when I started here 9 years ago, reserves were in the 60 million level, and they've gradually gone down, and at one point hit just under 20 million in around 2017, just before the law changed to extend the levy overseas. We'd pretty much hit the bottom of the barrel. So we and the board were very keen to ensure that while the benefits of the levy were immediately felt, the increase was felt, that was a good time to start to rebuild what we had. So we've managed to get reserves up in that 2 year period from around 20 million to around 50 million. But at the same time, this year, we've been able to, particularly this year, 2019, have been able to spend considerably more And the main focus has been on prize money, but the key point about the prize money is that it was aimed and has been aimed at the middle to lower tiers of the sport. I think it's really important that people recognise that how much of the levy income is derived from day-to-day racing. I think people are often surprised in a good way that it's the repetitive nature of three fixtures a day, four on Saturdays, two evenings and one or two twilights. That's what keeps the wheels turning. And important as the big festivals are, Grand National, Cheltenham, Royal Ascot, those three festivals combined probably wouldn't generate more than 5 to 7% of the levy. It's the day in, day out racing that keeps things going. And for that to keep going, you've got to ensure there's sufficient reward for people there. But at the same time, of course, we know that it's the top races that are the big generators for commercial interest in the sport, sponsorship and race going. So what we're trying to do all the time is find a way of balancing the things that we spend the money on to come up with as close as you can to an optimum spread of fixtures and revenue across the sport.
Okay, I'm guessing from that then that you don't agree with a lot of the criticism that there's too much racing. Your figures would suggest that you need it to keep going.
Yeah, I think it's easy to say that. In fact, it's easy to say both things. It's easy to say there's too much racing, and it's easy to say you should have more fixtures, because to some extent, you can't really prove either of those things is not true. But it's certainly easier to prove the argument for more racing being better than less. And the Levy Board has been absolutely at the forefront of growing the fixture list in recent years. I'm absolutely sure that that has led to racing's income in total going up. In part, that's because the media rights model, and bearing in mind that racing now gets more in media rights than it does in levy, while those media rights models are based largely on the volume of racing, it's very attractive to add more fixtures on. So I think the argument for cutting is more difficult, and you really have to show that by cutting, there's going to be some benefit to the sport. That's much more difficult. Of course, the sport's got to have enough horses, enough people, but and you can't underestimate that. Obviously, the sport can't operate without them. But it's much more difficult to make the argument positively for reducing your income, because we know pretty much that if you cut fixtures, you cut media rights income and you cut levy.
Okay, Alan, the Levy Board have recently agreed an extra 6.5 million payment one-off in prize money to compensate for media rights losses. Do you think that some racecourses rest on their media laurels and do very little to actually try and encourage people to come into their racecourses to raise funds themselves? And should the money you give them be in balance with what they actually put up themselves for prize money?
Well, on the first of those, I think you probably could have said that, you know, 20, 25 years ago, where when I started in racing, the commercial effort that racecourses made was very mixed, and you could really see who was making a real effort and who wasn't. I think two things have happened. The first one is that racecourses have generally become much more commercial. Their marketing and promotion initiatives are much better than they used to be. And I think you'd struggle now to think of a racecourse that does a particularly bad job in trying to get people to go. I'm sure they will all say that they can do better, of course. But the overall standard has got a lot better. And the second thing that's happened is that prize money agreements have been put in place between the racecourses and the horsemen, principally racehorse owners. And the rise of the professionalism in the owners and horsemen side of the business has become marked in the last 10 years or so. So that the existence of those agreements, okay, they lapsed the last couple of years, but they're now about to be reaffirmed, really ensure that racecourses have to commit a certain amount of what they get from their own sources back into the business. We ourselves have always insisted that what the racecourse must put something in to get something out of the levy. So about two-thirds of what we give to racecourses in prize money is dependent entirely on what they themselves do in performance terms, what they put into prize money and what they generate in levy. Now, you could argue that those incentives are not great enough, that we could do the whole thing based on racecourse performance. We don't. We have a bit of it that's just a fixed payment. But in there somewhere, what we're trying to do is encourage racecourses positively to do better. So the better a racecourse does against similar size racecourses, the more we're able to give. And that upward-looking meritocracy is designed to ensure that racecourses have a reward for investing in the sport.
Okay, do you have a benchmark for each racecourse, what you would expect their revenues, etc., to be? And if they fall below it, do you carpet them and say, look, guys, you've got to up your game a bit?
We don't, but that's the benefit, that's the purpose of the prize money agreements. So the prize money agreements, as I understand it, although they're not our agreements, but they're the racecourse and the horseman's group, they require a racecourse to put a certain proportion of its revenue into prize money. If it fails to do that, then there are sanctions available, I assume, that the horsemen can look to enforce. We do it more positively in the sense that if a racecourse is losing ground against its peers, it will lose money from us. So, you know, that's just a straight reward mechanism. We're not looking to punish racecourses or say to them, you're not doing well enough. There's a mechanism that says, if you put this in, you get this out. If you don't put that much in, then you'll get less out than everyone else, and relatively speaking, you'll start to fall behind. What will be interesting is, because the media rights payments have been structured to some degree on a quite similar basis between racecourses, that difference in performance hasn't really led to such a great gap emerging. But if you start to create different media rights arrangements which are based much more on how each racecourse does in terms of betting, then you could potentially see quite a significant divergence where the most attractive racing starts to get the biggest share of media rights. It will also get the biggest share of the levy. So there'll be a natural working together of the media rights and the levy mechanisms if they're both based on how well a racecourse does itself.
Okay, and are those things taken into account when there's a code snap and the racecourse is applying for extra meetings?
Yeah, so what we do generally is to try to provide some protection for racecourses. It's not fair that if a racecourse has lost four fixtures in January and February that it gets no money the next year. We will apply an average to that fixture. So because it's not, if you said to a racecourse, if you race in cold weather months and it's abandoned, you get nothing. Racecourses won't race at all. There's got to be some protection for them in there to run a fixture programme. It's hard enough as it is to persuade racecourses to run in the very early parts of January, for example, where attendances are low. I think by saying to them, if you do it, you'll be you know, you're making a significant loss as well. I don't think anyone would do it. But that's what I mean, I'm trying to find a fair way of treating racecourses, but obviously not to be doling out huge lumps of cash that we don't need to.
Okay, I mean, do you think it's fair to say that expectations are lower on some all-weather tracks, despite the fact they're based around massive cities and nobody turns up?
Expectations of?
Of attendance and people actually coming through the turnstiles. All the ones you can think of, you don't have to name them, they're all on the edge of big cities. And they don't seem to be able to get 1,000 people in. Surely they should be able to, if they really tried.
I think that's really difficult for me to answer. You know, there are certain racecourses that you know, we can all think of that you would look at their attendances and say, well, why do they get such a small number of people going, whereas other racecourses in cities get a massive amount going? Now, is that because of a failure by the racecourse? Well, it could be, but if so, there are quite a lot of racecourses and a lot of leisure pursuits that all seem to be failing. So maybe it's not just proximity to cities. There are lots of other reasons in there. I'm sure racecourses all want more people through their gates, of course they do. But I do think there's nothing wrong with recognising that a significant amount of racing isn't there primarily as a for the race going public. I think that's absolutely fine, as long as you wouldn't run a fixture programme of 1500 fixtures a year if your only revenue stream was people going. We benefit, I said earlier, we benefit significantly from the day in, day out staging of racing. That's what makes the tills open and close, and I don't think there's anything wrong with that. We're not saying we don't have a model that says every lower grade fixture in an unattractive race going slot gets to keep all the levy money. Quite the opposite, that money is channeled by us up through the system to what might be termed a more aspirational race program. Now, there's a counter argument, not least among the racecourses that run those fixtures, that say actually they should be allowed to keep what that fixture generates in levy. That's not a view that the board has ever taken, because if you go down that route, you simply keep piling on races and fixtures, and you don't invest upwards into the system. But it's not a bad argument to make. It's just not one that's ever found a majority view here. But I think the fundamental point that it may not be right to look at the total number of fixtures as the way to judge whether the right amount of racing is there, I think is a good one. To some extent, it matters where those fixtures are placed in the fixture list. It matters what happens to the money that's there. And I think if you go down the route of saying, well, actually some fixtures are pure and we like those ones, but we don't like these ones, you have to think very carefully and see this as a ecosystem. I hate to use the phrase, but there's a lot of flow of money and people all around that system, and I suspect that there aren't many fixture slots that you could take away and end up with no damage being done to racing's income overall. Not to say the racing has to go on adding to the list. There's probably not much appetite to do that. But given how fixtures are rewarded at the moment, you'd be quite brave to say, let's slice a lot out of them. But of course, in there always is, do you have the horses and do you have the people? And those are two of the biggest challenges facing racing, particularly on the people side. Racing is in a very competitive marketplace for staff to come and work in the industry.
Okay, one of the things, Alan, in your specific priorities is integrity. Now, do you think that having a plethora of low-grade, all-weather meetings is a problem to keeping that integrity in the sport?
Well, in itself, no, because I think that the overwhelming majority of people that are involved in the sport are doing it on a completely straight basis. And I think you have to be careful about equating the value of a race with people behaving badly. It almost suggests that those who are the least well off are disposed to doing wrong things. I think that's not a good way of thinking about people and their motivation. But clearly, if you have races where the reward is relatively lower, then I'm sure that the regulator, BHA, keeps a very close eye on those races, because there are horses that maybe have a different season mapped out for them, a different campaign mapped out for them for different reasons to something running up through the top handicaps. But I think all that you can do is to say that the public confidence in the sport is essential. We provide, it will be about £20 million this year out of a total bill of about £25 million for integrity purposes. And the sport, I'm sure, is fully behind BHA in keeping the sport clean. But I think that the public confidence point is crucial. That if people didn't think that the races there were fairly run, then the interest in them would be significantly less. I don't sense that that is the case. I think there's a whole different question about handicap marks, and which is a whole, you know, another interview about the way that the sport creates handicaps and where the incentive is to get your horse down to the lowest possible mark to have its best possible chance, and how you go about that. But I think there's a distinction to be drawn between, as I remember one trainer putting it to me, you know, plenty of horses that I've run in races that I knew they couldn't win, but I've never put a horse in a race and told the jockey not to win. And I think that's a very helpful way of looking at the two sides of the coin.
Okay, now finally, everybody obviously depends on bookmakers making money. Now you've given a £500,000 profit starting point before the levy kicks in to independent bookmakers. That's very benevolent of you. Why did you do that?
Well, the real credit for that goes to the government, because the government changed the regulations in 2017. But we ourselves have been saying for a number of years that we were collecting levy from about 1,000 different betting operators, but the vast majority of those operators, and I mean the vast majority, were paying a relatively small sum of money. So all on-course bookmakers, I mean, one of the very far-sighted things that Levy Board did maybe 20 years ago, 15 years ago, before my time here, was to change the way that racecourse bookmakers paid and stopped it being on a gross profit or turnover basis, but just paid a fixed sum of money per year. So we were collecting, I think it was £240 a year from hundreds of on-course bookmakers, and not very much money from a whole range of betting shops, which weren't making a huge amount. And we recommended to the government that they looked at whether this structure was right. So the effect of doing that has meant that we now collect levy from no more than about 60 bookmakers. It clearly has been beneficial to on-course bookmakers and to the smaller operators, which was one of the intentions behind the change. So I think that for the benefit of, again, the ecosystem of racing and betting, having something in there that's designed to provide a bit of a break for the smaller operators is something that's in tune with our thinking and government's thinking.
Okay, Alan Del Monte, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's not just online betting at Star Sports. You can call us too on 08000 5-1 3-1 and speak directly to one of our friendly and experienced traders. BeGambleAware.org. Over 18 only.